From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Beth Ruyak.
All members vote or desire to vote.
Members, this budget is not our preference.
Share the pain.
We got to stop the game.
No baloney.
Taxes, taxes, taxes.
The next step's the governor's.
Only the good Lord knows.
Mr. Secretary, call the roll.
That's the cue for Capital Chat, and in case you're wondering, this segment has now moved to Thursdays so we can bring you some wonderful special programming on Fridays. Tomorrow, in place of Insight, a documentary that takes a look at the future of nuclear power 1 year after the devastating earthquake, tsunami, and nuclear accident in Fukushima, Japan. Now back to today. Our Capital Public Radio Capital Bureau Chief, Ben Adler, joins us today by phone for Capital Chat. I'm trying to see how many times I can say Capital, Ben.
keep going. Let's hear some more.
Our Capital Bureau Chief has a new survey out for us. It's a statewide survey with some pretty interesting results. So let's start there.
Sure. It's from the Public Policy Institute of California. And it shows, once again, what it seems like most polls, when you talk about California's income, sales tax, budget situation, shows, and that's there's kind of a paradox, and it's this: if you ask voters, you know, have you been impacted by budget cuts? About 2/3 say they've been affected a lot. If you ask them how they feel about the proposed trigger cuts that would kick in if the governor's proposed tax measure fails this November, they're overwhelmingly opposed.
Yes.
70%, including, 60% of Republicans. But in this poll, only 52% of likely voters in California support the governor's tax initiative. And by the way, independents are 49% yes, 41% no. Democrats and Republicans split about the way you think they would be. And then furthermore, if you ask voters, how do you want to close the budget deficit, which, by the way, if is either somewhere in between $9 billion and $13 billion, depending on who you ask, or perhaps getting a little bit larger because of some other factors going on with the state right now, 45% say a mix of spending cuts and tax increases. 11% say mostly through tax increases. So that gets you to about 55% total who would favor some form of tax increases, some or all, and then the remaining 35% or so mostly through spending cuts. So you take all that, you put it together, and you have kind of a mishmash, a mixed signal, if you will, that voters are impacted quite a bit by the budget cuts, but they don't necessarily favor using taxes to solve it. At least a significant minority at this point do not favor that.
Well, and it just does speak to the fact that there's no easy solution for us. I was looking at another note in that poll, and that is, Ben, that 84% of the voters still believe the state is in a recession. And we are getting information saying the economy is turning around and we are slowly recovering. But 84% would say that either people at the level of their lives are not feeling it or they don't believe it.
Yeah, and that is, especially in an election, you're going to have an impact. And if California voters are feeling financial stress still in November, will that affect their tax vote? Because there will be, can't say will yet, but it is very likely there will be multiple tax measures on the ballot, the governor's and the millionaire's tax and Molly Munger's education tax. And so, three tax measures on the ballot and folks feeling that the state is still in a recession, seeing a big budget deficit, seeing big budget cuts that they don't like. How is that all going to come out in the polls? And anyone who tells you they know should probably wait till November.
Well, it is interesting that there was a slight majority supporting the governor's tax initiative. I don't know at this point whether 52% is a healthy, good number for the governor to have on that initiative. For me, looking at it, that number was a little higher than I expected. What about, what's the take there?
It's lower than it's been in a couple of other polls, but this is the first time the Public Policy Institute of California has asked specifically about this measure using the official title and summary that will be on the ballot. And so it's a little bit apples to oranges to make comparisons. And also the PPIC did not poll on the other two tax measures, the millionaires and the Munger. So it's hard to compare those as well. And Furthermore, they didn't ask what would happen or what voters would think if all three taxes were on the ballot, if that would drive down support for all three, which is an argument the governor and his supporters have been making and trying to urge the other two initiatives to keep off the November ballot. So it really is hard to say. Usually, if you don't start out with majority support for an initiative, it's hard to get over that 50% threshold. But I think if you're the governor and his backers, you would like to see it a little bit higher than 52% at this point.
You did say that 70% in this poll opposed the governor's trigger cuts. And in a week where we've seen major protests regarding any education increases on the higher education front, I think we should also note that the trigger cuts to the K-12 school level budget or funding is especially not supported. That was even a higher rejection, up around 72%, I think, wasn't it, Ben?
Yeah, I think we're talking about the same number here. I kind of rounded.
Oh, you rounded
to 70%.
It to 70.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's a real difficult one on the education front. But Mark Baldessari with the Public Policy Institute usually has some kind of summary statement or his take on the findings as the pollster. What did you hear from him?
Well, I chatted with him yesterday for a few minutes I kind of asked him to look at all of the results on the taxes and the attitude toward the budget that we've just been talking about, and then two other findings of the poll on statewide issues of note. The $11 billion water bond on the November ballot, 51% of voters saying they would support it right now, 35% saying no. So a narrow majority, just barely over 50% saying yes on that. And that's despite the fact that about 70% of likely voters say it is very or somewhat important that voters pass the water bond. So there's a big gap between folks who say a water bond's important and the people that would vote yes on that water bond. And then also high-speed rail, which has gotten obviously a lot of criticism lately. Likely voters, only 43% of them favor the project at this point being built, 53% oppose, although there's broader support, there is slight majority support among all adults. So you take the water bond, you take high-speed rail, you take the responses on the taxes and the budget, and what does that all add up to for the PPIC's Mark Baldessari?
I really think if you look at the package of how people are thinking about the tax initiative, how people are thinking about the water bond, and how people are thinking about high-speed rail, it all suggests that we're at a fragile state in our economy. People are concerned about spending both their money and the government's money, and they are showing some resistance to the idea of big spending items right now.
Well, there you have it. We're speaking with Capital Public Radio's Capital Bureau Chief Ben Adler in our Capital Chat on Thursday. Let's cover two more issues quickly if we can, Ben. And that
sure.
is California maybe being in play here for the Republican primary.
Yeah, and because of Super Tuesday not necessarily bringing closure to the Republican primary race, attention now turns to the next states. And California, still 3 months away. The primary is in the first week of June, first Tuesday in June. And it could easily wrap up before the Republican race reaches California, but it might not. And at this point, I think anyone who tries to predict the Republican presidential race may want to skip that for now, given all the twists and turns all that the race has seen. But the PPIC poll did have some findings on, if the vote were held today in California, what likely Republican voters' preferences would be. Mitt Romney, 28%. Rick Santorum, 22%, and apparently that is within the margin of error for Republican likely voters. Newt Gingrich comes up with 17%, Ron Paul, 8%, and 22% are unsure. And then the other finding of the poll that I want to just highlight real quickly is, when asked if they are satisfied with their choices of candidates, 45% of California Republicans said yes, 45% said no.
Oh, my. Oh, dead even on that one.
Yeah.
Well, I saw they did give the governor an approval rating of 46%.
And it has kind of been hovering around there since he took office about a year ago, never really getting higher. His negatives were, his disapproval was low to start with, and it has kind of gotten up a little bit closer. But when the legislature has an approval rating in the low 20s or upper teens.
Yeah, 21%. Wow.
Yes. 46% sounds pretty good to the governor.
Okay, Ben, we're going to have to go, but you've been on the spending cap story, and I don't want to leave without having you address it with a sentence of closure. So can you do that?
Okay, a sentence of closure. Let's see, how to say this in, 15 seconds or less? There had apparently been efforts towards a spending cap, a hard cap on state spending by the Howard Jarvis Taxpayers Association, California Taxpayers Association, and other conservative groups, and they had, to much fanfare, unveiled their proposal for the November ballot. We broke the story Tuesday afternoon saying, we're kind of thinking maybe November 2012 not the best spot for this measure to go on the ballot. Could be three tax measures on the ballot that they're going to need to focus on. A lot of din, a lot of noise around the around the November election with the presidential race and everything else, and just too much stuff to deal with, and not enough money necessarily to qualify. They could qualify the measure, but to run a strong campaign. So that is the deal with the spending cap. That would be a victory for Governor Jerry Brown and Democrats, who had been pressuring business groups to stay away from this measure. And so the governor has not been able to get his rival tax measures off the ballot, but he is apparently having some success with the spending cap.
Okay, we had closure there, literally, figuratively, and on the clock in every which way, Ben Adler. Thank you very much.
All right, we're good. Thanks, you're welcome.
Have a good one. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Up next, we have a conversation about the Colorado ownership of some of Tahoe's biggest ski resorts, with Kirkwood becoming the latest purchase. We'll be right back. You're listening to Insight. I'm Beth Ruyak. If you're wondering whether this is a good weekend to head up to the mountains, the answer is yes. The snow is still piling up, and the ski and snowboarding season has some of its best weeks still ahead. From a business perspective now, there is news. With the recent purchase of Kirkwood Ski Resort, two large Colorado companies now own five of the largest ski areas in the region. So what's happening? Yesterday, I talked about this with Blaise Carrig, co-president of Vail Resorts, and Andy Wirth, the CEO of Squaw Valley and Alpine Meadows. I started by asking Mr. Carrig about Vail Resorts' development plans for Kirkwood.
Well, the development plans, the real estate for Kirkwood remains with the current or former owners. And our interest in Kirkwood is really only in the ski resort piece. And so our plans for Kirkwood really revolve around just, you know, improving the ski experience there and having Kirkwood as an addition to our other resort portfolio in Tahoe, Heavenly and North Star.
And Andy, Squaw Valley and Alpine are owned by KSL Capital Partners of Denver. Those purchases happened over the past 2 years. So for KSL, is this part of a bigger trend?
Oh, I'm not too sure I could say it's a specific trend. We certainly, along with Vail Resort, see that this region, the Tahoe region, has tremendous opportunity. As ski resort operators, just as Mr. Carrig said, we see there being great access for the customer across the country. We see terrific skiing conditions. Typically, this year's been a little bit of a deviation from that. But we think that there's overall tremendous opportunity on developing and enhancing the ski experience here for customers not only from Northern California, but also destination customers from across the U.S. and international origination points.
And Blaise, Vail's properties come with these, you know, wonderful kind of communities that get built up right in the center. And the same has been true for Squaw's development as well. So what about that issue of change being dependent on development?
Yeah, I see it the same as Andy said. I don't think that that's necessary. And for our properties at North Star, there already is a well-developed village. It's pretty new. And we just see the opportunity of getting much better utilization of the existing bed base at North Star. And I think that that's also true for the South Shore. There's, you know, with the casino properties and a lot of condos and hotels at the South Shore, I think there's still opportunity to do a better, utilization and that we can bring more business into both of those markets without necessarily having to develop. Again, Kirkwood for us is totally a ski play. The real estate stays with the current owners. And again, there is a development that's already there that I think before, things necessarily move forward too much, everyone would like to see more people just coming to the resort to ski as it is today.
Let's actually talk about the skiers. And skiers care about snow. They care about getting to it and then the price of a lift ticket. Would you agree on that?
Absolutely.
At the price of a lift ticket, I think what they care about is what's the value.
Right.
You know, what are they getting? You know, I mean, every vacation comes with a cost. And I think, in these days, the consumer really, does a really good measure of, what am I getting for what am I paying? So I don't think it's necessarily the price of the lift ticket as much as what is, what's the experience that I'm getting overall for the dollars that I'm spending.
Gentlemen, some people think it's a foregone conclusion that the changes or development or corporatization, if you want to call it, of the Tahoe area resorts is naturally going to drive up the price. Is that right or wrong?
Well, I guess I'll jump in and say I think it's fundamentally wrong. I think what you've seen is actually people getting better product offers so far. When our company came in, the season's pass prices at Heavenly alone for one mountain were, somewhere near or upwards of $1,000. And, we took those prices down below $300. And, now you can buy a pass that's good for Heavenly and North Star in the, in the high 300s. And, we'll be adding Kirkwood onto that. So, I think that the consolidations have brought a broader market access and a different view of how you sell the products that give the consumer, I think, some incredible value options out there. I mean, I think if they, choose to go to the ticket window, that's one pricing, but there are so many other options that I think we've brought to the table that overall you'd have to say that it's been good for the consumer.
Andy?
Yeah, I agree with Mr. Kerrigan that I think the premise is fundamentally wrong, and actually the past couple of years proves that in that, our approach, number one, our company's headquartered out of right here in Olympic Valley, California. Number two, our view is that these are resorts here, Squaw Valley and Alpine Meadows, that have not been optimally managed or capitalized. And we are investing in the experience, and we think effectively managing the resorts. But more to the point of our actions speaking louder than our words, our pass prices actually decreased year over year, and they've actually been on a 3-year trend downward. So there's actually interesting equations going on here where there's increased capital investment in the experience at the same time decreased pricing, and I think that's really important for the customers to understand. It's a different focus, and it's less about this concept, which is really just a concept of corporatization. I think it's a handy speaking point more than it is real. And what we have is people very focused on the experience, very focused on what we can do more effectively and how we can invest dollars more wisely in enhancing the experience and therefore enhancing the value equation. Ironically, we're charging less than previous ownership did, which, by the way, was a corporation.
So for that, would you each talk about the passes available at each and to where they apply? Because things have changed at Kirkwood, I understand. So, Blaze, do you want to start by talking about the passes for each group of ski areas?
Two years ago when we purchased North Star, we combined a pass in Tahoe that includes Heavenly and North Star. And then there's also another pass with our Epic Pass where you can get the Tahoe resorts as well as ski all of our Colorado resorts anytime under the Epic Pass. Our looming acquisition of Kirkwood. We haven't closed on the acquisition yet, but we've signed an agreement. And as of a couple weeks ago, we've allowed skiers in Tahoe that if they have a Heavenly and North Star pass, they can ski at Kirkwood. And we've had people doing that already. And if people have a Kirkwood pass, they can ski in North Star or Heavenly.
It was my personal experience that snowmaking during the drier time was quite strong at North Star. It was not quite so strong at Squaw. Did you have issues with snowmaking this winter, Andy?
We didn't have issues. We had a relatively fewer snow guns, and at Alpine Meadows we had tremendous success with making snow. And the company historically had not invested in snow making. We're making changes to that investment strategy, and we'll be coming at it, if you will, great guns ablaze coming into this upcoming ski season. We're working with some of the best mountain planners in the world. The world's best mountain planners in evaluating what we can get done. So there's really not there was rumors to the lack of water, and that's really not the case. It was really, frankly, previous decades of a lack of focus and lack of investment. So we're accommodating that going forward.
I'm talking about the consolidation of Tahoe Area Ski Resorts with Blaise Carrig, co-president of Vail Resorts, which now owns Heavenly, North Star at Tahoe, and as of February, the process of purchase of Kirkwood is underway, and Andy Wirth, who is CEO of Squaw Valley and Alpine Meadows, which are now owned by KSL Capital Partners of Denver. You're both part of the Reno Tahoe Winter Games Coalition, is that correct?
It is.
That's right.
So this consolidation and the influence of your companies in the Tahoe area, the plans that they have, does that help the effort of the coalition?
Well, it's interesting because, Beth, we are, in fact, competitors, if you will, but we also have, I think, collectively a strategic view of this area. And the Winter Games, the prospect of hosting the Winter Games is something that would bring great favor and benefit, we feel, to the area. And so in this case, we're able to set aside our competitive nature and come together. And in this environment in particular, we've actually worked together on this group, worked together to do some venue feasibility analysis, and then established that we don't have just one great speed alpine venue, which is Super G and Downhill. We have three. They happen to be down at Heavenly. We have a couple of great Nordic venues that are possibilities. So we're actually in this space working together because we think this can serve the greater good of the region. Of the many needs I think we collectively see, the one includes the need to enhance the transportation infrastructure in this area. And that's one of the great benefits that serves us.
Well, in your effort to bring the Winter Games to the Reno Tahoe area, Sacramento had an important vote last night, and that was for the proposal of a new arena in this city. Is that a factor in your effort?
It really isn't, Beth, in that one of the worst things we could do is prescribe venues too early in the game. The USOC, nor does the IOC, look upon that approach with favor. Most certainly, Sacramento is a remarkable place, and certainly this would have to be taken into consideration. But the key thing right now is to not jump the gun and prescribe venues too early. But I am pleased to say that actually quite recently we're converging all of the different efforts, including the Sacramento-based group, the Reno-based group, in terms of collecting the effort to put together what might be, the key word is might be, a 2022 Winter Olympic bid. I was obviously aware of the stadium vote. I thought that was terrific. I'm a basketball fan myself, so I'm thrilled for Sacramento that the Kings get to stay. But I think creating a nexus or some kind of tie between our Winter Games effort and the stadium is a little bit premature.
One last question to each of you. Skiers here will talk about a natural vibe to the Tahoe area and a feeling on the mountain that every loyalist can describe by being there. Hard to translate in words to somebody else, but I know you know what I'm talking about. What's the emphasis of each of your companies in preserving whatever that natural vibe and feeling is for the loyalists?
You know, for our company, we have six resorts, and with Kirkwood, we'll have seven. And, we like to say that we're big where it makes sense and we're small where it makes sense. And where it makes sense to be small is, you know, absolutely cherishing, respecting, and preserving those elements that you know, make the vibe and the, in another word, or the brand and the position of each resort. And, I think we've done that. If you, we've been in Tahoe now for over 10 years. The Heavenly experience is totally different than the Kirkwood experience and is totally different than the North Star experience, and they need to be. They all appeal to a different customer, You know, people want that variety even when they buy the multi-resort pass from us. So in our minds, that is probably one of the most cherished things in the business, is that we, you know, you've got to protect that core element of what is the resort. What do people, what really stirs people's passions about a resort? You can't play with that.
And Andy, your properties are in the Olympic Valley, and not much more be said than that about the ownership that everybody feels to that valley.
No doubt. And I think what's critical to understand is I am, along with my executive team and even ownership at KSL Capital Partners, we're all very, very passionate skiers and snowboarders. So it's actually not very hard for us to come in and consciously make the effort to learn, to understand kind of what the scene is, what the vibe is, as you well articulate it. And I think we've done that. And we understand that there's a great diversity of views of Alpine Meadows and Squaw Valley. And we have utmost respect for what's happened in the past, including the Winter Games, all the way up to Hot Dog the movie. And I think, you know, all of these, every ski resort in North America has its own place in history, has its own unique scene. Alpine Meadows and Squaw Valley are certainly as special and unique a pair of resorts as I've ever seen. I think the best example I can give you is my first winter here was last winter, and I had the opportunity to ski KT-22 with the legendary big mountain skier JT Holmes, which for me was a real honor. It was the equivalent of getting a tour of the Vatican by the Pope. And it was through that experience that I was really introduced to KT-22, one of the most legendary peaks of all of skiing, by somebody who was born and raised and has literally made his career off of growing up on that mountain. So I think what it really comes down to, in addition to what Mr. Kierig said, is we get it. We're on the mountain. I'm as engaged on the snow side of our business as I am on the working with my CFO on managing the business. It's part of who we are. It's in our DNA, and we have the utmost respect for that. And frankly, it's so critical to our long-term success to preserve that.
Well, I want to say thank you to both of you.
All right, Beth.
Yeah, Beth, thank you, and please don't hesitate to mention all the snow we've been getting lately on your program.
Absolutely. And I will say, in checking the reports today, that a number of ski areas are saying they have 8 to 17 inches of new snow in the last 3 days. And if you scout around, there are many ticket discount offers right now online at a variety of websites. The spring snow season after a dry winter is really terrific. So happy winter, everybody. And thanks again to Blaze Kierig of Vail Resorts and Andy Wirth of Squaw Valley and Alpine Meadows. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. In a few minutes, we'll hear some traditional Indian music live in our studio. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Beth Ruyak. Let's find out what's happening today with senior editor Alan Ray, and he joins us from the newsroom. Alan, hello.
Well, good morning, Beth. Democratic Assemblyman Richard Pan of Sacramento is also a pediatrician, and he's concerned about the dental health of kids, particularly about increasing problems with the dental safety net known as DentiCal. He'll be meeting with people at a community clinic in Oak Park at noon today to urge more better dental care for the children of the poor. Employment keeps going up. Unemployment, therefore, keeps going down. All that slowly. One expert has told NPR that unemployment could be below 8% nationally by the November election. But the hiring recovery is still going a lot more slowly than it has in the past. As is usually the case, small businesses are doing most of the new hiring, but computers and technology are making it easier for even small businesses to do more with fewer people. That story from NPR this afternoon. The story is what new tech is making small business needs. And amongst other things, small business apparently even needs fewer people than it used to. Those stories and more coming up beginning at 3:30 this afternoon on All Things Considered from Capital Public Radio.
Okay, Alan, and our Kings won by 1 point
last
night.
Yes.
Hooray. Yeah.
Yes.
All right. Monday, by the way, Sacramento Mayor Kevin Johnson will join us on Insight. If you have a question for the mayor, be sure to send us a message on our Capital Public Radio on Facebook, or you can link to our Facebook page via capradio.org. South Indian classical music might not be a genre you can immediately identify, which in some ways is an invitation for you to attend a lecture performance Friday night at UC Davis. The featured guest is Sikil Gurusharan, who is with us today on Insight. Welcome, Sikil.
Hi, thank you.
it's nice to meet you. And I said, were you in the United States or where did you come from most immediately? And you said, oh, I just came over from India.
Yes.
India to UC Davis. So how did that happen?
Well, last year around fall, I was giving a music tour in the United States for about 60, 70 days. And one of my concerts happened to be at Sacramento State University, organized by people from India. And one of my friends who is teaching at the UC Davis, Archana, she happened to attend the concert, and we struck upon this idea of having a lecture concert somewhere in the near future. It is really good that it happened almost immediately. About 5-6 months later, I'm here again.
And is it Facebook or Twitter or what kept you connected?
It's first basically
phone?
The oldest method is face-to-face connection. And then we went back to the newer methods of Facebook and email, and it happened.
So describe your music for people.
Well, South Indian classical music is a very it's a sublime music form. It's deeply emotional and it's very ancient, needless to say. And most of the songs and most of the outpourings that musicians do on stage is directed to the divine power above. And most of the songs depict gods and goddesses from South Indian tradition. And not only that, we have usually the concerts go for about 2.5 to 3 hours typically. And we have songs in it. And we also improvise a lot on stage, so South Indian classical music can be said to have two different dimensions. One is the exact art form that we have learned, and the one which we improvise on stage.
You have given a perfect setup for us to hear some of this music, and I believe that the song that you have for us in its translation, the title is somewhat generic. It's called the South Indian Carnatic Philosophical Song.
Yes.
Correct? I'd like to hear it, and then afterwards we'll talk a little bit about what the song means and,
sure.
and what Carnatic music is.
Definitely.
Kandriyan kuralai kettu kanindu varum pasum pol ondrukkum அஞ்சாத என் உள்ள துயரம் ஒன்று குமஞ்சாத என் உள்ள துயரம் நீக்க என்றைக்கு சிவக்ருபை வருமோ ஏழைக்கென்றைக்கு சிவக்ருபை வருமோ.
Thank you, Sakil.
Thank you.
What did that song mean?
Well, actually, contrary to my statement earlier, this song is actually more of a philosophical one. It is directed to the divine power above. It's on Lord Shiva, you might be aware of. But it reaches Lord Shiva through a very mundane level of expression. It doesn't portray Lord Shiva. It doesn't speak about the divinity, but it speaks about how man should live life, and he lives life only once, and how that should be. So the rough meaning, this is a song in one of the South Indian vernacular languages called Tamil. So I'm from Tamil Nadu, so the language we speak is Tamil. So this song, composed by one of the early 20th century composers called Nilakanta Sivan, it depicts how, it's actually a song about waiting. The devotee actually waits to be liberated from the worldly life that he has. So just like a calf, when it cries for help, the mother cow comes running to its help and sees to it that it is comfortable. Just like that, he places himself in the position of a calf, crying out for deliverance to the Lord. And he just wants to, you know, it's on a more, ethereal level, the song speaks about being done with all the worldly desires, and he's just waiting for deliverance from the Lord. He wants to go to the next level.
I'm speaking with Sikhil Gurusharan, who will be doing a lecture performance Friday night at UC Davis, and information will be on our website, capradio.org. As you were playing the music just now in our studio, the sound that actually, I think, gives it that crying out feeling comes from a drone. And it's very small. I think it's like 3 by 3 inches, but this is not the usual drone that you perform with. Will you talk about that a bit?
The usual drone that we use for giving us the pitch, I sing in the pitch called D. Usually South Indian music musicians use a particular pitch for their whole performance. I use the pitch D. And the usual drone, which we call as tambura, it's quite huge. It's made of wood and has 4 strings attached to it. And each of the string is tuned to my pitch D. And we have a person who keeps strumming it for all the 3 hours. And then later on, since musicians started traveling abroad, and we could not really, you know, carry this huge instrument.
How huge are you talking about?
It's about
5 feet, 6 feet?
Yeah, almost 5 feet. Mm-hmm. Because it has to have that depth in order to have the right resonance in it. And then we also have the electronic version of it, a smaller one, which we call the Shruti box, the pitch box. And now I'm presently using the MP3 player, which we have recorded the real sound of the tambura or the drone, and we play it whenever we are asked to sing.
And technology helps again, doesn't
Definitely.
It, Sikhil?
I'm a huge technology freak.
Well, and yet you're really traditionally grounded. Music goes back generations in your family, doesn't it?
Yes, I'm the 4th generation musician in my family. Mm. My great-grandfather was a percussion artist from South India, and then my grandmothers were, and still they are, probably the only flautist duo in the whole world. Yeah, they play the flute, and they've been
flautist
in service.
Duo.
Yeah.
Wow.
They were playing for nearly 70 years. So,
Sikhil, you need a YouTube video of them.
Yeah, that is a YouTube video.
Oh, is
there? You can go and search for Sikhil Sisters. That's the name of my grandmothers. They are sisters playing the flute, and
okay.
Their town is called Sikhil.
S-I-K-K-I-L, which is your first name,
Sister.
Sikhil
and
Sisters.
My first name is Sikhil, okay. And my name is Gurucharan, so you can YouTube both these names and find out the family tradition. And they were the 2nd generation musicians in the family, and then my mother and my aunt, who also play the flute. And then I came into the picture and I took up vocal music. I took up singing because my grandmothers insisted me to do that.
Well, I feel like I've gotten a mini lecture and performance here today. So thank you so much.
You're most welcome.
And again, we'll mention that Sikhil will be at UC Davis Friday night. And this is at the TCS Building Art Annex. It is open to the public, correct?
Yes.
6 to 8 p.m. We'll have more information on our website and search for those YouTube videos. I'm going to look up your grandmothers, by the way.
Please do.
Thank you so much. It was a treat to meet you and a treat to learn about your music. And I wish you success and come back when you come back to Northern California.
Certainly. Thank you, Beth. It was
Thank
a
you,
pleasure.
Sikhil. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, we're going to switch genres and remember Luciano Pavarotti on today's Sound Advice with Sean Bianco. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Beth Rujak. Capital Public Radio's Sean Bianco, host of At the Opera, is in studio with us, 14 years on the show and our resident opera buff. My first opportunity, though, to work with you, Sean.
Yes. Hello. How are you?
Very nice to meet you. Welcome to Insight. And you've chosen to remember the Italian tenor Luciano Pavarotti today.
Yes.
Is there a particular reason?
Yeah. I think that in this day and age, the way media is and our culture is, we tend to forget people very quickly. We tend to forget events, people, things that are important. And a couple weeks ago, I had a very interesting encounter with a couple of 20-somethings who asked me what I was into, and I said opera. And they said, well, who's big in opera? And I said, well, Pavarotti was big in opera. He was huge. And they said, who? And a little light went off in my head. And I thought, you know, I have to do more to remember these people, because if people in their late 20s don't know who Luciano Pavarotti was, it's like asking somebody who doesn't know who Elvis was, or, you know, Michael Jackson or whatever. So I decided today that I was going to do something called Remembering Pavarotti, as much as we can do in 10 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to hit three basic highlights or high points in his career. First off, his debut. His debut was on April 29th, 1961, in the opera La Bohème by Giacomo Puccini in the role of Rodolfo, a role that he did at all his important debuts around the world, and he considered it a good luck opera and a good luck role for him. And one of the most amazing things about that opera in Act One is the tenor has to sing this beautiful aria, and in it there's a very, very high note, a high C. And he recorded this aria in 1974, and it's considered by many people to be the most beautiful high C ever recorded by a tenor in the 20th century. And so I included his debut aria, part of the debut aria, Puccini's La Bohème, and I want the audience to hear that beautiful high C that he sang.
You know what, Sean? I don't know if you're just catching me on a day or if it's just the magnificence of him, but
yeah.
I hear that note, I think of him, and I just feel teary.
I do too.
We've really lost something when we lost him, but how grateful I am that people like you bring the music back.
Yeah, and you know, I feel so lucky to have my opera show. There are so few locally produced opera programs in the United States, let alone on a public radio station, so I'm very lucky to have my show and to keep opera alive.
He was just an amazing man, though, the way he took Italian opera and moved it into pop culture. And
yep.
I mean, he was on Saturday Night Live.
Oh, I know.
He was the musical guest back in the late 90s.
Yeah, and he also appeared on The Tonight Show, I think, 11 times.
Oh, my God.
Johnny Carson. So yeah, Pavarotti was very much part of popular culture. Because he had more than a great voice, he had a personality. He had that it factor, the kind of factor that we will give to a performer like Judy Garland or Elvis Presley or,
right.
you know, Michael Jackson or somebody who had that extra something special that set them apart. And having seen him live myself, I experienced it firsthand. It was unbelievable. The explosion from the audience around me when he finished a song. And I was like, okay, this is special. You know, I was like,
you feel it through your soul, don't
Absolutely.
You? It's not just sensory with your ears. It's
no.
a living, organic experience.
It was. And people who saw him live often said that it was as if he was singing directly to you personally when he sang. And if a whole auditorium of 30,000 people are all feeling that exact same thing, imagine the response at the end of an aria. Yeah.
Well, he was an amazing man, and when he combined with Placido Domingo and Jose Carreras and became the three tenors, which
That's
they
right.
did back in 1990, then it got boosted even another level.
It did. You know, and I actually have a clip from that concert. But before we get to that clip, I want to briefly mention the next moment in his career that really launched him onto the international opera world and into the world of Time magazine. He was on the cover of Time, and that's when he appeared at the Metropolitan Opera in the early 70s in an opera called The Daughter of the Regiment. He was brought there by an Australian soprano and her husband, Richard Bonning, who a conductor, and Joan Sutherland was a soprano. And in that opera, the tenor, the role of Tonio, he has to sing an aria where he hits nine consecutive high Cs, right one after another. Pavarotti did this live for an audience in New York in the early 70s, and that was it. He was termed king of the high Cs, and the rest was history. So I have an excerpt at the very end of this aria with all nine high Cs.
Okay.
So let's hear it.
Yeah.
right
Sean,
in a row.
We should be jumping.
I know.
I want to dance when I hear it. I want to be up.
And that made him world famous overnight.
Well, world famous on that level. He was an amazing humanitarian.
Yes, he was. Yes, he was. In fact, a lot of people do not realize of all the humanitarian efforts he did. For instance, he raised a lot of the earthquake money for Armenia. He, in 1988.
I think of him with the Red Cross.
Yeah.
I think of all that work over
right,
the years.
Right, and he, also for the concerts were held for War Child, victims of Kosovo, Iraq, Bosnia, Guatemala after their wars. And also close friend of Diana, Princess of Wales,
oh.
where he raised money for the elimination of landmines worldwide. And, of course, he was awarded High Commission for Refugees by the Nansen Medal in 2001. And, of course, the Red Cross Freedom of London Award as well. So he was an amazing humanitarian. And in the, like you mentioned, the Three Tenors concert, Jose Carreras, Placido Domingo, in that concert, he did the big aria that also relaunched the whole interest in opera, Nessun Dorma from Puccini's Turandot. I have brought a recording of that live Three Tenors concert, and the proceeds from that concert benefited the Jose Carreras Leukemia Foundation. Let's hear the very end of the aria.
I can hardly listen. I just would hope that those 20-somethings come across this. You are the right person to be teaching, and you should do more of this, Sean.
Well, thank you very much. And like I said, we lost him, in 2007 of cancer at the age of 71, and he is dearly missed, and I miss him horribly.
Well, you're amazing because the audience right now listening isn't seeing that you are talking all about him just from the top of your head. You're not reading notes. You know so much about his career and his music, and it's really beautiful just to watch you talking about what you love.
Thank you.
Yeah, Sean, thank you so much. And we will close the show with a little bit more of him.
Yeah,
you have
why
one
not?
More
Go
piece.
For it, yeah.
Thank you. Our sound advice this week with Sean Bianco. I look forward to you coming back again.
Thank you for having me.
And thank you for the gift of the day today with Luciano Pavarotti.
You're welcome.
That's Insight for today. We want to give you a reminder that tomorrow, in place of Insight, we have a special program looking at the future of nuclear power. This is 1 year after the earthquake, tsunami, and nuclear accident in Japan. It's called Particles, Nuclear Power After Fukushima. That's tomorrow at 10. I'm Beth Ruyak. Insight's assistant producers are James Morrison and Lynn Weaver. Today's associate producer was Sarah Jung. Our senior engineer is Mark Jones. Our theme music was composed by Joe Gilman and Paul Conley. Insight's executive producer is Joe Barr. And then, of course, there is you. So thank you for joining us. Oh.